This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where the news has been dominated by Donald Trump and his triumph in Nevada. We have the final tally with 99% of the precincts reporting on the very first slide. Donald Trump with 45.9%, Marco Rubio 23.9%, Ted Cruz 21.4%, John Kasich 4.8%, Ben Carson 3.9%. This is a record turnout in Nevada. And it seems to have been motivated by anger. I have a report here that I think makes a lot of sense, suggesting that Nevada Republicans are mad at the government. This may not be much as a surprise, but the voters don't want a politician to address that anger. 6 in 10 Nevada Republicans said they were looking for the next president to be someone from outside politics. That's 6 in 10 of a huge turnout. 70% of them voted for Donald Trump. Now, Bernie Sanders has been looking at poll results about how he and Hillary would fare in a race against Donald at this point in time. And his assessment of the Huffington Post average of recent polls has Sanders 51 to Trump 41. That's a 10-point spread. Hillary 48 to 44. That's only 4. So, therefore, Bernie is making the argument he is a better candidate to take on Trump. I'm very pleased to say this evening that I have an avid student of Donald Trump, Rick Shattuck, who runs the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness in Washington, D.C. Rick has been a student of Donald Trump and has a great deal to share with us this evening. Rick, welcome to The Real Deal.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm with the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness at 1629 K Street in Washington, D.C. As far as being a student of Donald Trump, I did take some online courses in real estate, which have been very helpful and enabled me to purchase homes in both Washington, D.C. and Fairfield, Iowa, which has come in very handy. Being able to do lobbying activities in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill for 9/11 and other good causes, such as delivering the petition for a new investigation along with Richard Gage and Architects for and Engineers for 9/11 Truth volunteers. And then in Iowa, to be able to visit the candidates, and I was able to see Donald Trump 8 times, shake his hand 5 times, give him materials to sign 6 times.
Yes, and when I use the term student, I mean it in a broad sense that you're following Donald Trump, you're analyzing what he's doing, you're watching his behavior closely, and I think you have a lot to share with us, Rick. We can begin with your slide set when you're ready.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, this will cover 10 trips for truthers talking to Trump, based on my experiences. We'll talk a bit about the 9/11 debate coming up and the Hirsch Index. So, just a little background. I mean, I spoke on The Real Deal in 2012 about critical thinking and open-mindedness. And we had an event about Sandy Hook where Dr. Fetzer talked to our group, the Fairfield, Iowa Truth Awareness Society. More information I have about my research is at shattuckresearch.org and an Eagle Scout and Mensa. And I say thanks to TM because I wanted to give a little plug for that because it has helped me so much in my life. It helped me get my grades better and the honorable discharge in the U.S. Marine Corps, having a chance to rest before PT.
And you're talking about transcendental meditation.
Yes, that's right. And I have a Master of Arts in Education from Maharishi University. I've been a computer consultant in Washington, D.C., and director of the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness, lobbying Congress for a new investigation of 9/11. And I own homes in Washington, D.C., and Fairfield, Iowa, near the Group TM, about 500 people practicing twice a day, raising national consciousness from near the population center of the Earth, spreading out brainwave coherence, and making Americans more receptive to the truth. We see that with the rise of consciousness, the public doesn't want what they've been getting. And it surprised everybody. Nobody predicted last year that we would be in this situation where Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders for the Democrats are leading in many of the polls. So I visited Donald Trump rallies 8 times and Donald Trump Jr. 2 times as they campaigned in Iowa. And we'll cover some top 10 tips. And I'm also organizer of the annual 9/11 physics debate. Okay, so in the next slide, I was just an average high school student. I learned TM. It helped me become an Eagle Scout, a Monroe County tumbling champion. You know, it seemed just easy to do backflips and easier to do. My SAT scores went up. I got into Mensa, which is high IQ society for whatever that's worth. Colgate University, a competitive college that my parents and my older brother never thought I would get in. He didn't get accepted to Colgate, but I did. And honorable discharge from the U.S. Marine Corps, a Master of Arts in Education. My thesis was on critical thinking ability and EEG coherence. TM helps to improve the coordination between the left and right cerebral hemispheres. I spoke on The Real Deal in December 2012 on that topic, and The Real Deal episode in December 2015 covered the Sandy Hook hoax. And thank you, Dr. Fetzer, for talking to our group. I was on the Kevin Barrett show a few times and Andrew Steele's 9/11 freefall show. I'm working on a master's degree in digital currency. That's like Bitcoin from remote the University of Nicosia in Cyprus. And my goals are to achieve a PhD and get a Hirsch index of 10. And these are some of the diplomas. Okay. Now in Washington, D.C., worked as a computer consultant for World Bank, USAID, embassies. I worked as a defense contractor for the Marines, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard. Taught over 1,000 staff at the Pentagon at their training center. I worked on a several-year contract for the NSA as a programmer and for NASA for a procurement tracking system and through company Computer Sciences Corporation. Now, after the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in 2003, many contractors were overbilling the government. It was quite a heyday in those years. And YouTube started in 2005, and I saw Loose Change by Dylan Avery on YouTube, and I was in denial for a while, but finally realized about 2006 that 9/11 was a hoax.
Well, really, really a false flag that was blamed on parties other than those who were actually responsible, that it was an inside job.
Yeah, exactly. So as a U.S. citizen and Eagle Scout, I want to be on the good guy team. So I moved back to Iowa, got back into regular TM to improve brainwave coherence, and it helps to develop cosmic consciousness, the realization that we are all one universal self. And the people in Afghanistan, Iraq, are other like little selfies, part of our big self. A professor at Marist University, Dr. Jonathan Scheer, wrote a paper about how TM fulfills the description of Plato's dialectic, that is turning the mind in the opposite direction, inwards instead of outwards towards the senses, and develops neuroplasticity, the ability to change one's mind. So there's actually a physiological component to how stubborn people are. Some people, if they don't have a lot of neuroplasticity, with all the evidence, they still can't change their mind. We've encountered some people like that. And helps us to act in accord with natural law. So the illustrations here, that's Plato and his academy, and Maharishi, who brought TM to the West. That's the Golden Dome, where hundreds of people practice There's also a ladies' dome. This is Jonathan Scheer and the study that he published in the Journal of Metaphysiology, Philosophy. He would be an interesting guest sometime on your show, Dr. Fetzer. I like TM because it's the only meditation that has real scientific research. That means peer-reviewed studies, over 600 studies published in peer-reviewed journals. You know, there are a lot of forms of meditation, but with anecdotal, support, but I like for something with scientific research behind it. And over 20 million funded by the very conservative NIH, they wouldn't fund something like meditation unless it was really something good, because they would get objections from taxpayers who are, overly biblical and, think that, well, why don't we get funded? Oh. In 1972, American Journal of Physiology published an article, A Wakeful Hypometabolic State. So hypo means it's slowing down the physiology, yet we're still awake, which is the description of restful alertness. So Dr. Herbert Benson of Harvard Medical School and Dr. Robert Keith Wallace published that study. And since then, there have been many studies. I also like how TM attracts very top scientists, such as Dr. John Hagelin, PhD in physics from Harvard. And also his bachelor's degree from Dartmouth, he finished in 3 years. And so instead of four, that's pretty good. And he was summa cum laude. So he's not only the smartest one in his class, he was the smartest person in his class of people a year older than him. Scary smart. And he is talking about the unified field and how it relates to consciousness. Okay, so TM has been found to improve grade point average and IQ, reducing stress and drug abuse by improving the coherence of the electrical activity between the left and right cerebral hemispheres, and also developing unused areas of the brain, improving blood flow to different areas of the brain. And it also helps people get off drugs. And, as for me, I haven't had any, desire for drugs. There's a natural high that we all can achieve, which is much better than any high that we would get through drugs. So the TM is a bit of an avenue that I had with the Trumps to be able to talk to Donald Trump Jr. at more length. TM has a lot of celebrities following it. Of course, the Beatles went to learn TM in India with Maharishi. Clint Eastwood was on Merv Griffin. That's what sold me. Clint Eastwood does. My inspiration, Joe Namath, Oprah Winfrey, Jim Carrey, the comedian, Jerry Seinfeld, Ellen DeGeneres, Cameron Diaz, Hugh Jackman, Jennifer Aniston, Dr. Deepak Chopra, even Howard Stern, and David Lynch are speaking out on behalf of TM. And Dr. John Hagelin also ran for president in year 2000 with the Natural Law Party, and ran for Congress. So one of the platforms was to bring this rehabilitative technique to prisons, to rehabilitate prisoners and to improve students' performance. Also, Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka do TM, and Ivanka wrote in on her blog that it's one of the most important things she does every day, and she offers it as an employee benefit to her staff to improve productivity. Okay, veterans may be interested. Know that TM has been found to improve alertness and reaction time, and that's why there's a group of scientists who are bringing it to the military. It also, when practiced in groups, helps to disallow the starts of enemies by enlivening the field of peace, the unified field. That of consciousness that connects all of our minds together at a very deep level. Dr. David Leffler has written hundreds of articles published in various newspapers and journals around the world. He's the head of the Center for Advanced Military Science. The website there is strongmilitary.org. And David Lynch has a foundation for helping veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome to recover, called OperationWarriorWellness.org. Okay. Now, in Washington, D.C., when I came back to Iowa, it seemed to me that we really need to have an association for those who are 9/11 truth activists. I had worked for 52 associations near Kate Street in Washington, D.C. There are associations from A to Z. There's one for the American Bar Association. There's an association for zoologists, association for all sorts of professions seeking influence with Congress. And I had been voluntary for the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, but we could also use an association for those who are not architects or engineers or pilots. There's also firefighters groups. So the model that those other associations were using could be helpful for 9/11 Truth. So we have I hope to co-found the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness, Lobbying for Congress for 9/11 Truth. And a shout out also to Diane and John Michael and Ziggy, who are helped to found the association. And we also work closely with the AE 9/11 Truth and delivered petitions to every member of Congress and Senate. The petition of over 2,500 architects and engineers who want a new investigation. And we also help with websites such as 911police.org, encouraging people to go to your local police and talk to them about 9/11. You'll find they're surprisingly receptive and just helps to build awareness nationwide that we need a new investigation. And police are the ones who are really supposed to investigate this crime. There's a couple links that we have on there to our political action, and that is going to Capitol Hill, and but also approaching the FBI and other agencies to try to get a new investigation about 9/11. Now, in Fairfield, I helped found the Fairfield Iowa Truth Awareness Society, and I suggest that people do this in their hometown. Each month we cover kind of a conspiracy topic, and we can use the local public library for free, and they have a very nice big screen. For example, Dr. Kevin Barrett came to talk about his book on Charlie Hebdo, the Paris incident. We've talked about 9/11, JFK, Martin Luther King, moon landing, O.J.'s son, Jason, O.J. Simpson's son, and Sandy Hook. And that's at FITAS.us, Fairfield Iowa Truth Awareness Society. And we also have a Facebook channel. Okay, so it occurred to me that while watching CNN and hearing Donald Trump, that he would be a good person to approach about 9/11. He said on CNN that Bush was a liar and the war in Iraq was a disaster. He said that to Wolf Blitzer. So, wow, we don't hear too many people talk like that. And so Dave Schlesinger, who's an MIT graduate and avid 9/11 truth awareness proponent, he and I tried to contact Donald Trump about the high-rise safety initiative. Is there something that Donald could really get behind? Of course, the high-rises need to be safe. Also, Wayne Costi, who is a professional engineer, and, of course, Richard Gage, trying to get an appointment with him. We also made a website, trumpcommission.org and .com, to be ready for Donald Trump if you'd like to redo the 9/11 commission, and this time, cover all the evidence. I've tried to inspire him to inform him and expose Larry Silverstein. It would be like Trump, I would think, to want to put Trump on the top of the World Trade Center towers. If he would help to expose Larry Silverstein, who those tenants may want a new landlord, one that would not let them let 3,000 tenants die so he could get $4.2 billion from insurance. So, and I also I was able to get contact with Donald Trump Jr.'s secretary, LinkedIn, and I made a trip to Trump Tower but was not able to get an appointment. So it was really hard to get to talk to Donald Trump, even before he was running for president. So then I saw that Donald Trump is visiting Iowa, and at these events, 9/11 truthers will find that you'll have a chance to shake hands and talk face-to-face to Donald Trump maybe for a short time, maybe for a longer time. So we organized Rise through Facebook and other means and made a website, TrumpFairfield.com. We're able to see Donald Trump in Oskaloosa, Burlington, Newton, Des Moines at the Iowa State Fair, where he flew in with a helicopter and gave rides to children, Fort Dodge, Iowa City, Muscatine, and Davenport. And he would fly in with the Trump jet, which was very impressive to see at the Moline Airport. And the other presidential candidates were visiting Iowa, too, up since Iowa is the first to do its caucus. I was able to see and shake hands and talk to Senator Bernie Sanders in Ottumwa, Iowa. And I asked him about the 28 pages on 9/11, since he is a senator and it is his job to read those 28 pages and know about them. But he didn't really respond. You could check out the video and see if you think he really heard me or not. But I mentioned it a number of times. And he was also at the Iowa State Fair. So I saw him there again. And I said, Bernie, please read the 28 pages. Senate Bill 1471. Senate Bill 1471. And he kind of said, oh, yeah, okay. So I hope he does read those. I also talked to Lindsey Graham. Now, he was very easy to talk to because only about 10 people showed up at his event in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And I asked him about the 28 pages and also made a video. And these videos, by the way, you'll find at Truth on my YouTube channel called Truth Makes Peace. You can also get there at truthmakespeace.com. It takes you right to the YouTube channel. So, well, Lindsey Graham said on the 28 pages, he said, well, I haven't read them. I mean, these senators are supposed to read these bills so they can vote on them. And on TM for Defense, he said, well, I'm for anything that works. And I also was able to see, wasn't able to shake hands with Hillary Clinton, too many Democrats around. And Ted Cruz, I was able to shake hands with him and talk with him at for about 10 minutes in Mount Pleasant, which is the birthplace of Dr. James Van Allen, who discovered the Van Allen belts of radiation surrounding the Earth 1,000 miles to 25,000 miles with radiation of 100 rem per hour, which would be very sickening if not fatal. Dental X-ray only gives you 0.1 rem for about a second. But Ted Cruz, he had not heard of the Van Allen belts. Now, he's a lawyer by training, so I thought maybe I would talk to him about 9/11, but on that opportunity, I thought, well, since he's the chairman of the Senate committee overseeing NASA, he should know about the Van Allen belts. And I thought it would be too much of a stretch for him to talk about the moon landing. But another point is that NASA should be funding efforts to go to the moon for real, whether you believe it or not, because the Russians are planning to do that. And my wife, who came from Russia, she says everybody in Russia knows that the moon landings were fake. So they're happy because it gives them more time to catch up. I also was able to talk to CNN's reporter Suzanne Melville, who from time to time has filled in for Wolf Blitzer as an anchor. And she had not heard of the 28 pages. But I told her, whoever will cover this, you know, could maybe get a Pulitzer Prize. And Rand Paul also visited Fairfield, Iowa, and Washington, Iowa, which is nearby. And I mentioned that in the House, they have a Resolution 14 to release the 28 pages that Bush classified about who helped fund 9/11. And Rand Paul said, yes, I'm getting ready to do that on the Senate side. And a week later, he did introduce Senate Bill 1471 about the 28 pages. So, but I was able to talk to him a bit about the Ace Elevator Company, which was working in the shafts from 1994 to 2001, and they were never even mentioned, not much less investigated by the 9/11 Commission. And Securicom, the security company, also not even mentioned in the 9/11 investigation, much less investigated. And, of course, Larry Silverstein just mentioned in passing that the Silverstein Properties was the managing landlord of the World Trade Center, but, you know, never investigated, even though he got $4.2 billion, you know, within, you know, a couple months of his becoming the landlord. So, I was But also encourage everybody to contact your congressman. I ran into my congressman at a coffee shop, and I asked him, will you please join the other congressional representatives who have signed House Resolution 14 to declassify the 28-page chapter that George Bush classified about who helped fund 9/11. It looks like the Saudis were involved, because without funding, the attack would not have happened. So he said he would said, that's interesting. He'll send me information to the office, and I did, and he sent me a nice letter, but I haven't seen his name yet on the signing on to the House resolution for that. So we need politicians who will really read these bills and act on them. At Oskaloosa, Donald Trump gave a picnic treating hundreds of people, contracted a company called Hy-Vee, which gave out hot dogs, hamburgers, salad, drinks to a lot of people. Now, it's not like he's trying to buy votes, but it does show fullness and, you know, financial fullness. And it's unlike other rallies where often people are asked to make donations. So he said, I don't want anybody's money. Just enjoy today. Enjoy the food. And then after the rally in the main auditorium, I wanted to talk to Donald Trump. And so I walked around a bit and saw a room. You know, I just happened to walk down the right halls. It's kind of supportive nature. And there was a press conference. And I wore a tie, as you can see. And I was better dressed than many of the reporters from the New York Times and NBC who were just wearing jeans. And so the lady at the door asked me for my press credentials. And I said that I'm, oh, that's a nice blue dress you have on. And I'm with Truth Makes Peace, the news blog. So she said, okay, and she let me in. So I was able to ask Donald Trump about the 28-page chapter that George Bush classified and the WTC building attack collapse. So I'll bring in YouTube, which is queued up at the near the right point here. Let me just back it up just a little bit and play it. Okay. There we go.
I think just to be forward about it, I wonder how to wonder the Hispanics. Both very big. So we're very happy about that. You know, it's, you know, the very
okay, he's talking a little about Nevada now.
Yes, you know, years ago he correctly identified George Bush as lying to get us into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And there's a House and Senate resolution to release the 28 pages that George Bush classified about who funded that we can have an attack without funding. Would you support the release of those 28 pages to the public? It's 28pages.org.
I was close to
Okay, so for that question, he didn't know, he had not at that point heard about the 28 pages, but and then he began speaking about how he was one of the few who was opposing the invasion of Iraq from the get-go. And then later on, he gave me another opportunity to ask a question, and this time it was about the World Trade Center collapse. So I said first that as a builder of skyscrapers, you know that they're built to be strong. So would you support a new investigation of the collapse of the World Trade Centers? And so he didn't really answer that, but I hope that he had, would start thinking about that, because he knows that buildings are made of steel and concrete specifically so that they will not collapse during a fire. So he made
many skyscrapers.
Here it is.
And many people, according to a poll from YouGov, 60% of Americans have some question about how those towers came down. And then, and how the World Trade Center 7 came, was not even hit by a plane, and companies that were not investigated, like Ace Elevator Company, they're in the shafts from 1994 to 9/11. They were never even mentioned, much less investigated by Bush's administration. Right. Well, would you support an independent investigation of the way the towers came down? Just Americans are calling for independent investigation of people who could have.
So, all right. So at that point, at least I hope that I got him thinking about 9/11 and informing him on a couple topics, such as the Ace Elevator Company and the polls that show that 60% of the people have questions about 9/11. Okay, so that got written up in the New York Times blog and the Washington Post. The Examiner said, "Truth 9/11 truther stumps Trump during campaign event." And it was repeated through some other magazines, such as Mother Jones and my local newspaper writing about my encounter with Donald Trump. So there are opportunities where people could speak with Donald Trump at a press conference, and he often has time for questions at the events. So I would say there's no need to really jump out and scream or interrupt his event, which one fella did. Which I know he means well, but I would say that there are other opportunities. And it's clear that by now Donald Trump does know that there are many suspicious things about 9/11. At the Newton, Iowa rally, after he spoke, he always goes down to the people in the front row and goes along and signs such as hats or signs or brochures. And so I gave him a 9/11 brochure from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So he looked at that, and as he was signing it, I was saying that over 2,000 architects and engineers want a new investigation. You know skyscrapers. You know those look like controlled demolition. So he kind of nodded, and he signed his name. That's his scribbly signature there. And then at another rally in Davenport, I made a paper that said Larry Roger and Lisa Silverstein were not in World Trade Center on 9/11. The World Trade Center had asbestos and had to come down anyway. Glassner helped Larry win the bid to get the World Trade Center, even though Vornado Company bid more to become the managers of the World Trade Center. Larry still won the bid, and he got $4.2 billion from insurance only 6 weeks later. So as he was coming down and signing these things, he gave it back, and I think with a knowing smile and a little bit of a salute, like, right on. Yeah, I know that Larry Silverstein is, there's something suspicious about that. Certainly all the real estate developers in New York City must have wondered how Larry was so lucky on 9/11. At another event in Quad Cities, I brought a paper this time, because I had seen that he's starting to talk about Bush's not keeping us safe on 9/11. But I also wanted to inform him about the TM technique and what it's doing for veterans to help those with post-traumatic stress syndrome to relax and release all that stress. And Trump said, "That's great." That's also on a video on the Truth Makes Peace channel. And I gave him this paper about Operation Warrior Wellness from the David Lynch Foundation. Now, Jerry Falwell Jr., who is also touring with Donald Trump, also read it. And he said, "Yeah, I'll make sure Donald gets that." I was going to get his autograph, but he put it in his pocket. So I thought, that's great. Okay, he'll give it to Donald Trump on the Trump plane as they go back to New York. Well, Donald raised $6 million in one day for veteran support. And gave a big check to an organization that's helping to provide dogs to veterans to help them relax and have a companion during their recovery. And perhaps Donald will look at the scientific research behind the TM for Vets and perhaps fund that effort. Donald Trump is very difficult to get in touch with by now. Hundreds and hundreds of people are trying to talk to him. And Donald Trump Jr. and his son, his other son, Eric Trump, also were touring. Ivanka is not touring because she's very pregnant right now. And in Mount Pleasant, Donald Trump Jr. was meeting at the Pizza Ranch. And I had a chance to talk to him about 30 minutes. There were not that many people there. And so I talked with his wife, Vanessa, about TM. She knows about TM, and she practices it too, and how the Maharishi School students are doing very well on their SATs, and they're winning science fairs and spelling bees, and so she really liked that. And no, women, I think, are less wanting to talk about 9/11 because, you know, it's kind of a negative subject. 3,000 people died. So when she left for more pizza, I talked with Donald Trump Jr. about 9/11 and about Sandy Hook, since he's an avid hunter and Second Amendment proponent.
Tell me about the Sandy Hook conversation.
Yeah. Now, that was shorter because I was first talking about 9/11, and I was able to get in that Sandy Hook is very suspicious, and you want to look into that because it seems to be a hoax designed to curtail our Second Amendment. And I said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, an investigator, Wolfgang Helbig, and a professor of logical reasoning and critical thinking, Dr. James Fetzer, find there's evidence that the school was closed in 2008, which is 4 years before the event. And now at that time, a lady wanted to have a selfie with him, and another lady wanted him to kiss her baby, and someone else wanted him to help with a sick relative. So a lot of people were trying to talk to Donald Trump Jr.
Were you able to mention nobody died at Sandy Hook?
The book...
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mention the book. But we should send him one, and that would be a good follow-up. In Albia, there was another opportunity to talk to him, actually the next day, and that was in a restaurant for kind of a brunch and coffee hour. And there I had more chance to talk to him about the 28 pages that Bush classified about who funded 9/11. And... again, there were a lot of people trying to ask him questions. I thought maybe I was going a little too much on the conspiracies because he said, you know, I'm not here to talk about conspiracies. I'm here to talk about my father running for president. So I thought, okay, I better back off. and I asked him, Mike, what do you think about Bitcoin? Do you have any? And he said, no, I don't. And so I got his email and sent him his first Bitcoin. Digital currency, which I think will help to end the monopoly of the Fed. So here are some, just from my experiences, to offer people who are around the country as the Trumps come to their state, some top 10 tips. So look for when Trump is coming to town. Now in Iowa, the Des Moines Register had a very good website where you could click on the candidate you want to find, and it'll list all the dates and locations where he's going to be. So other newspapers probably do the same thing. Go to rallies early so you can get a seat near the front and be able to ask questions and perhaps even be on camera as you ask the questions. Preferably raise your hand and be polite. Shouting, it doesn't endear him to 9/11 truth, and nobody likes to be interrupted. And they've heard a lot about 9/11 by now. So, and they are smart and know there's something very fishy, but you understand they can't say too much at this time about 9/11. So Donald Trump always goes down the front row, and he'll be signing hats, signs, and that's an opportunity to speak with him. And he's very nice. I heard a lady who he passed by her, and the lady said, Donald, please sign my sign. And he stopped, and he went over there. And I was supposed to, you know, man, he does have a heart. And bring something about 9/11 or the cause. Maybe Sandy Hook would be a good thing for us to focus on now for him to sign. Perhaps Dr. Fetzer's book. And, you know, keep it simple, something he can recognize at a glance, because he has to move along, and his Secret Service agents are watching every move and moving him along. Be prepared with an issue to talk to him about. Look for a press conference after the talk, and, you know, dress. I wore a tie, and I think that really helped me to get into the press conference. Watch for visits by his son, Donald and Eric, who are much more accessible. And read up on the Wikipedia links about them, you know, to know their children's names and wife's names. Ivanka's pregnant presently, so she probably won't be campaigning for a while. I would suggest joining the Trump campaign if you are Republican and so moved, because you can get the latest news on visits that may not be in the newspaper. For example, the visits at the Pizza Ranch was not published by the Des Moines Register. That was only sent out as an alert to people who were volunteering for the Trump campaign. And remember that 9/11 was not just done by Jewish people or any particular religion. Dick Cheney's Methodist, supposedly, and Bush is Episcopalian. The Trumps have many Jewish friends, as do I. And so we don't want to blame 9/11 on just one religion. There are many beneficiaries of 9/11, such as the military-industrial complex. Well, these are some of the Iowa campaign staff that I got to know. So I would suggest if there's an issue that you want to bring to Donald Trump's attention, get to know the people who are managing your state. And I found that they're very, very nice, alert, and conscious people. There was a caucus in Iowa on February 2nd. So my Iowa home is in Jefferson County, Precinct 2. So I volunteered to get up and say a word about Donald Trump. Every candidate had 2 minutes to have someone talk on his behalf. So my precinct is also includes the campus of Maharishi University. And Trump won this area, which I would say is a very high consciousness area, with 18 votes, which is twice what Rand Paul got with 9 votes. So Trump won the most enlightened precinct in Iowa, although Ted Cruz won Iowa in general. So I guess we need to have more people, more meditators in the dome.
But don't you think that was affected by him putting out a false announcement that Ben Carson was leaving the race and that his voters should support Cruz?
Absolutely. Yeah, and there was a mailer that said this is a...
You can go back that one slide, Rick, if you don't.
Right, and about the... You know, voting violation, you know, you open this to avoid a voting violation. I mean,
yeah, they sent out a brochure that looked official, but in fine print identified with the Cruz campaign saying if you don't vote, you could be prosecuted.
Yeah.
That was pretty dirty. Cruz is acquiring a reputation for that, where Rubio and Carson, as well as Trump, have all three accused him of dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think he's willing to go along with any official story, too. He's a chairman of the Senate committee overseeing NASA, and he hadn't even asked. He could ask, who's it, Charles Boulder, by the way, did we go to the moon or not? But he never did. So, all right, well, by volunteering for the Trump campaign, I was able to get software for my mobile phone and my laptop, which is called Ground Game, you know, the state-of-the-art software that could show with like a Google map with little pointers of where everybody was. I realized that I was surrounded by Democrats and gave the party, if they're a Democrat or Republican, phone number. So that assisted in making calls to get people to go to the caucus. Nice thing about the Trump campaign, I've also worked on Ron Paul's campaign in, you know, 2000, you know, the last election. And the 2008 election as well, and trying to get Ron Paul to be elected and at least respected by the GOP. When we went to the Republican National Convention in Miami, the GOP did not allow Dr. Ron Paul to speak. And that so angered us that we all went to a different venue to have our own presentation, own convention where Dr. Ron Paul could speak. And also, I do like Dr. Rand Paul, his son, as well, and his stance on the civil liberties. I really respect how he got up and did a filibuster to curtail the NSA spying bill. But for whatever reason, he's just wasn't able to get up in the polls, and he did drop out of the race. But in those other campaigns, they also ask for money, and you know, Donald Trump doesn't want anybody's campaign money. And they provide campaign materials pretty liberally, hats, bumper stickers. So it's very nice, in addition to, of course, what he stands for. So that's why I like the why I support Donald Trump. I think that he is our best hope for 9/11 truth. And I think it's clear now, when I was talking to Dr. Kevin Barrett, he was skeptical about whether Trump would be a force for the neocons. I am concerned about a few things about Donald Trump. His statements about torture. The torture has been found scientifically to not work. Not only is it immoral, it's scientifically, it impedes a person's ability to recall events. And, you know, we don't know when we went to college. If we were very stressed going into an exam, it's hard to remember details. So I do wish he would change his mind on that, because we don't need another Dick Cheney. It's kind of ironic, because he says that the New York Times does not always tell the truth. He calls Bush a liar, you know, the Bush administration a liar. And then he's going along with some of the things that they have said. So
is this your last slide?
Oh, this is on the last one on the Trump campaign. There is
Yeah. Yes, Rick, I think he's not a flawless candidate, but I think he's head and shoulders above the others, and that he's got the potential to shake up Washington in a way it's never seen, certainly not for hundreds of years. And therefore, the establishment on both sides are very upset with Donald Trump. He's been quite emphatic about the invasion of Iraq as having been a disaster, that we've squandered $4 to $5 trillion. We would have been much better off spending it on roads and schools and education and the like. I think that's commendable. He's faulted Jeb for suggesting his brother kept us safe, which, of course, is easily demonstrable that they did not take appropriate measures to protect the nation. The deeper reason, of course, being because they were complicit in the planning for 9/11. But if you accepted the official account, it's very clear that those who were attempting to inform the administration that they ought to be aware of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and the like, where Condoleezza Rice even had a report about Osama bin Laden determined to strike, Richard Clark, the anti-terrorism czar, and George Tenet, the director of the CIA, repeatedly sought to bring this to the attention of the administration, according to a simply brilliant article in Atlantic, mm-hmm. which it makes it very clear how if you accept account that Bush Cheney let it happen, of course we know better, they actually made it happen. Mm-hmm. But on the weakest interpretation, it would turn out that they were derelict in their responsibility. And I thought it was therefore extremely commendable for Trump to call Jeb out on that. Mm-hmm. Where Jeb, of course, turned out to be a lackluster candidate. He didn't have any pizzazz. He didn't have the proper president. He didn't come across as a leader. All mm-hmm. areas in which Donald Trump excels, where he conveys the impression of a very strong leader who has lots of ideas and a great deal of confidence. And I think the thought that he is a businessman, Rick, is very appealing to the country, that so many of these issues are economic and involve large sums of money. Well, Donald is used to dealing with large sums of money. He seems to understand trade and the economy like no other candidate.
Exactly. Yeah, and how to run a big organization. Exactly. Well, would I have time to cover a couple things that about
sure
having debate?
Go right ahead.
How many more minutes are there? Yeah. There's a 9/11 physics debate coming up on Einstein's birthday. It's the third annual one on March 14th, 2016. Now, in 2014 and 2015, the winner by default was Dr. David Griscom, who's a PhD from physics, and Brown, who's worked at the Naval Research Lab, NASA, DARPA, has 200 papers in peer-reviewed journals and a Hirsch Index of 52, which is very good. And
well, let me ask you, when you say 9/11 physics debate, are you talking about the destruction of the Twin Towers and whether it was physically possible or required extraordinary measures?
Yeah, the statement is resolved that the collapse of the World Trade Center towers violates Newton's laws of motion, was what they were to talk. But no physicists came forward in those 2 years. And we contacted 30 universities and two physics societies. So we sent them several emails, and I also call each department by phone, which actually is a lot of fun because some of these physicists, they just have not been thinking about 9/11, and it feels good to be getting them to think about it because, of course, they know the Newton's laws of motion. And no PhDs in physics with a Hirsch index. Now, first, we had the bar set at a Hirsch index of 50. Dr. Griscom had 52. And the next year, in 2015, we lowered it down to 40. We decided to just lower it down to 10 because we weren't getting any response. Now, none of these, I would get some emails, thank you, or, not interested in debating at this time. But you would think that they would be clamoring to defend the official story and, support their government. but no PhDs in physics seem to agree with the official story. It violates Newton's three laws of motion, for example, the third law of equal and opposite reaction. The top 10 floors would have collapsed the next 10 floors of made of equal material, maybe 10, maybe 20 floors, but it would have been a slowing of the collapse as it loses momentum by the energy necessary to collapse the steel and concrete.
Not only that, Rick, but the steel was like 6 inches, then five, then four, tapered off to the top.
Right.
And a retired high school math and physics teacher has calculated that the top 14 floors of the North Tower, for example, only represented 1.4% of the mass of the steel. And the idea that 1.4% could overwhelm the lower 98.6 is simply preposterous. So, it doesn't appear to have been physically possible for the buildings to have collapsed. The safety factor was 20, according to Skilling of the firm that designed and supervised the construction. There's no way those buildings could have collapsed. It required a massive source of energy over and beyond what gravity could provide. And most certainly the fires burned neither long enough nor hot enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt.
Right. And by having this debate, it forces them to make a decision. What side are they on? And hopefully they will start to discuss 9/11 physics with their students. So this year's physicist is Dr. Crockett Grabby, who has a PhD in physics from Caltech. And he was a guest on your show. And more information about it is at 911debate.org. And we've been advertising this debate since January, also on some of the forums, such as the former James Randi forum, to try to get someone to debate. So they talk as if they have scientists, but when they're called out and they have to come up with even one, they can't.
Rick, you have 2 minutes to remain to wrap it together.
Now, I mentioned Hirsch Index, and this for the audience. This is an index invented by Dr. George Hirsch, PhD in physics from University of California, and it's an objective measure of a scholar's books and publications and peer-reviewed journals. How often they're referenced, how long they're cited by other scholars favorably. And it's a very serious measurement used by universities as a factor in publish or perish, whether a faculty member gets tenure or not. It's not something that can be faked. The Hirsch Index for scientists can be found at the University of Illinois. They have a research guides website or Google Scholar. And looked up Dr. James Fetzer. You can Google James Fetzer, Google Scholar, and you have a very impressive Hirsch Index and number of citations. So congratulations, Dr. Fetzer. And it lists your publications. So you're up to like 25, I-10 Index 57, and 2,274 publications or citations. So
That's terrific, Rick, that you looked into that. I never have myself. I find it rather fascinating.
Yeah, and it's it really differentiates. As Dr. Griscom said in the debate, he said that he doesn't like to brag about it or tout his high Hirsch Index, but it is a score that can be used as an objective measure because you can imagine these people on the former James Randi forum, the forum that James Randi, they disowned because there was such lack of logic and critical thinking on there.
Well, Rick, you've got a super job here. I really appreciate it. I think this has all been quite fascinating, and I'm very glad you've stepped up to the plate here to make contact with Trump and his sons.
All right. Well, just one last point, if I could. Recent news is Richard Gage presented Dr. Noam Chomsky at MIT, the collected articles on 9/11, which are 22 papers published in non-truther journals as well. Filling a big binder. And, of course, there's also the 70-plus papers in the Journal of 9/11Studies.org, which you had do the editing for.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Thanking my very special guest this first hour, Rick Shattuck, for being here. Rick, you did a terrific job. Stand by for the new JFK show and a continuation of my response to the critique by Jim DiEugenio of Citizens for Truth about the Kennedy assassination. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television set. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
All right, welcome to the new JFK show number 93. This is round four of our response to the Jim DiEugenio attack on Dr. Fetzer, to be found at CTKA, part one and part two. It's called the Decline and Fall of Dr. Jim Fetzer. All right, so tonight we'll be responding to part two if you're going to be following along. So, Dr. Fetzer, I know you loaded for bear. You've got at least 60 slides, so let's go ahead and ring the bell for round four.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, here's the first slide, which is just general to, identifying myself. This is an author page on Amazon.com. Part two. Which should turn chance for some reason. The slide isn't advancing. Oh, there we go. It's not, he doesn't even include Dr. Jim Fetzer. It's just the Decline and Fall of Jim Fetzer, part two. And it starts about puzzling fact is my lack of a rigorous critical methodology. We'll take a look at that. Talking about people, embracing people like Judith Baker, Ralph Sinclair, Peter Janney in his book, Mary's Mosaic. And he talks too about, Phil Nelson's work, LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, which I have praised as a masterpiece. So let's take a look here. We notice that DiEugenio frequently cites individuals who are very familiar to the community, such as Josiah Thompson, where the first to call out Josiah was in fact Vincent Salandria, when he discovered that he concludes his book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, by denying there's anything there that supports conspiracy. We know, of course, that he has been a champion of the claim that the book, that the Zapruder film was authentic. And it's remarkable to me how this man has not only claimed to be an expert on the authenticity of the film, but overlook that in frame 374, you can actually see the blowout, which means that the film is not even internally consistent. Here you see a contrast between frames on the left where the blowout's been blacked out and on the right in frame 374 where it can be seen. In addition, of course, Josiah's argued that the chain of custody made it impossible for the film to have been altered, ignoring the fact that those who had custody were complicit in the alteration, which is the simple evisceration of his position, where Doug Horne has established that the original was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Saturday, the 23rd, an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas, and that the replacement was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Sunday, the 24th, a 16mm unsplit film where the substitution was affected. He also cites Robert Grodin, whom we have discovered also maintains that the film is authentic. Over and beyond that, although he is described as a harsh critic of the Warren Commission, he served as a photographic consultant to the House Select Committee on Assassinations and advised them that the shirt, the red and black checkered shirt that he claims Billy Lovelady was wearing, was a closer match to Doorman's shirt than was Lee Oswald's shirt, where Judith Barry Baker in her pixelation study demonstrated that to be completely wrong. It's difficult to take Grodin very seriously when he, claiming to be an expert on photographs and films, can't even spot the bullet hole in the Alton 6, which you can see on the left, where an arrow, it's visible where JFK's left ear would be if his left ear were visible as a small white spiral nebula with a dark hole in the center, but rather supports the spider web crack on the right circled in orange, which the Secret Service would later produce. But we know the windshield, the limousine was sent back to Ford. It was stripped down to bare metal and completely replaced. Doug Weldon even tracked down the official and replaced the windshield, who confirmed the through and through bullet hole. They put on a new clean windshield so that this, with a spider hole, has to be a third windshield yet to substitute fabricating evidence about the assassination to conceal the fact that a bullet passed through the windshield fired from in front. Then we have James DiEugenio, who is turning out, it seems, to be very slovenly in relation to his research. It may in part be because he's depending upon individuals like Josiah Thompson and Robert Grodin, who are completely unreliable, and where I was convinced that Josiah was about to disavow conspiracy for the 50th Observant, published an article about it, including entitled JFK and the New York Times, which was very revealing of what was going to be a series of short interviews, but which was abandoned possibly because my article took it apart so thoroughly. Now, here we have a very famous photograph, of course, the Alton 6, and we're talking about many aspects. Look, number one, of course, is circling the bullet hole in the windshield, which you can see very clearly. Number two, of course, is the man in the doorway, Lee Oswald. We've already demonstrated that doorman was indeed Lee Oswald. Number three is the window in the Dow Tex, and I noticed that the circles have slid slightly downward. They should be slightly higher, from which three rounds were fired by Nestor Tobias Cage, the only where, if you look directly below it to the vice presidential limousine, we notice that it's very difficult to discern the presence of Lyndon Johnson. Thus, Larry, would you like to read this first criticism from Jim DiEugenio?
Absolutely, Jim. Number one, Fetzer's approach to JFK case lacks critical methodology. This failing allowed him to accept and embrace people like Judith Baker, Ralph Sinquet, and Peter Janney, and his book Mary's Mosaic. This last example, his acceptance of a faultily premised book, leads into two other works that Fetzer accepted pretty much in their entirety. I am speaking here of Philip Nelson's tome, LBJ, The Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, and John Hankey's documentary film, first titled JFK 2, and then titled Dark Legacy, George Bush and the Murder of John F. Kennedy. To say that Fetzer praised the Nelson book would be putting it much too mildly. In fact, it would be a misrepresentation. Jim Fetzer called Nelson's book a masterpiece, quote unquote.
Well, something I find very curious right off the bat. Yes, I mean, we've already vindicated Judith Baker, Ralph Sinclair, and even Peter Janney. But, you know, Phil Nelson's putting the finger on LBJ, whereas John Hankey is putting the finger on George Bush. You would think that De Eugenio would have recognized that I very much support Phil Nelson's book, but that I have an interest in, but not a profound familiarity with John Hankey's work, though I did feature him to speak in Santa Barbara. Now, hear about Phil Nelson and the pivotal role of LBJ in the death of JFK. Phil was the first speaker in Santa Barbara. He's the author of LBJ, Mastermind of the JFK's Assassination, where he explains Lyndon Baines Johnson was the cardinal instigator of the plot to kill JFK. He forced his way onto the ticket as a vice presidential nominee in Los Angeles in 1960, telling reporters he had studied history and discovered one-fourth of U.S. presidents had not survived their term. He said he was a gambling man, but LBJ only bet on sure things. Philip explains how Lyndon Johnson was uniquely positioned to assemble the key men from the financiers to the operational planners and the cover-up experts to complete the job, and it was all done at the expense of a patsy named Lee Harvey Oswald. Here's an image of Phil giving his presentation, the first of six, that were presented in Santa Barbara. I do powerfully support the book, and so do many others. After having received 219 customer reviews on Amazon.com, for example, its average rating is 4.5. That's quite remarkable. And here, indeed, is a very, very good review as a sample. Truth Will Out, 5 stars by RR. This is a profoundly important book and an overdue book for reasons the author delineates in his work. In the U.S., it's called American Exceptionalism, Propaganda, Disinformation, and Societal-Wide Denial. Interestingly, it is said after the assassination, many Europeans looked at LBJ as being the perpetrator, since they did not wear the historical and ideological blinders of most in the U.S. I read a text and looks at Lyndon when it came out in 1964. I was 14 and interested in politics and philosophy. I read Best Evidence when it first came out 30 years ago, and dozens of books and hundreds of research papers on the assassination. I have long known that LBJ was deeply involved, as clearly indicated by his behavior before, during, and after the event, despite hardly any significant researchers willing to go even that far. James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable is a groundbreaking book in its synthesis of all the national security state strands that went into the assassination. However, I was stunned by the depth of Nelson's research and especially by the breadth of his integration of all the evidence into a completely logical and inescapable conclusion. As Vincent Salandria, Mae Brussel, David Emery, John Judge, David Lifton, Jim Mars, Oliver Stone, Noel Twyman, and James Douglas and others moved the case forward with their discoveries, research, and radical conclusions, so LBJ, the mastermind, takes us over the final hurdle to essentially reach the truth in the overall picture. Or is it the final word? Of course not. More information details will continue to emerge over time with the work of courageous private researchers. But we now have an accurate overview for the first time of the who, the what, and the why of this monstrous crime. A crime which not only changed America for the worse, far worse, but the world. Today's nightmare of increasing tyranny, continual wars, and overwhelming lies and propaganda is a direct result of the brutal murder of John F. Kennedy, just as Vincent Salandria and Mae Brussel predicted 40 years ago. Now, I regard that as a completely stellar evaluation of the book, far more well-based and competent than Jim DiEugenio's casual remarks, which I regard as having no substantial basis. Here's another, which happens to be my own, just to review the bidding, brilliant and pivotal, bringing coherence to our understanding. From first chapter to last, this is a beautifully written, intellectually captivating, and ultimately persuasive account of the role of LBJ in the assassination of JFK. I had more than 100 conversations with Madeline Duncan Brown, one of his many mistresses, but the only one who bore him a son. She, too, became convinced that Lyndon was profoundly involved in the death of his predecessor. On New Year's Eve, 6 weeks after the assassination, they had a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, where she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he had been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. He blew up at her and told her that the CIA and the oil boys had decided that JFK had to be taken out. She wrote about it in her book, Texas in the Morning. Her account has been reinforced by Billy Saul Estes, the Texas Wheeler dealer who made mountains of money for Lyndon, Connally, and their buddies, who explains in his book, A Texas Legend, how he became convinced that Cliff Carter, LBJ's chief administrative assistant, and Malcolm Mack Wallace, his personal assassin, by whom Lyndon had a dozen or more persons terminated, including one of his sisters, have been personally involved. E. Howard Hunt, in his last confessions in Rolling Stone, explained to his son, St. John, that LBJ, Cord Meyer, William Harvey, David Sanchez Morales, and others in the CIA had been involved in the assassination. For an overview, enter John F. Kennedy, History, Memory, Legacy, and Download, Chapter 30, or visit Reclaiming History of Closed Mind Perpetrating a Fraud on the Public, and you will understand the context within which it took place. For a short course, try reasoning about assassinations via Google. I also recommend James Douglas, JFK, and the Unspeakable. Both make profound contributions to the case. Larry.
Okay. CTK. I mean, let's start again. Green reviews Nelson's book for CTK, Sitka. As the reader can see by reading that review, we were at odds, again, with Professor Fetzer. To put it plainly, we found his unqualified endorsement of Nelson's book as a masterpiece, quote-unquote, rather dubious. Since Green's review was published, two new discoveries have been made, which weakened Nelson's thesis even more. Nelson stated with certainty that Johnson had ducked down in his trailing car as President Kennedy and Governor Connally were being hit by shots during the assassination. This is in Nelson's book, page 471 to 478. He wrote that the Alton's photo proved this, since Johnson is not visible in the picture. Nelson then concluded that this showed that Johnson knew what was coming. To say that Nelson plays this up to large effect does not do his hyperbolic treatment justice. Putting out all the stops, he pretentiously labels this section in his book the hidden key to unraveling the crime of the century. That's not even enough. He then writes that it is a prima facie proof of Lyndon Johnson's foreknowledge of the assassination. Ibid, page 476.
Well, the fact is that there's a mass of evidence, some of which I've already reviewed, where even Billy Saul recognized that Lyndon sent Cliff Carter, his chief administrative assistant, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. The most important part of Phil Nelson's book is not this remark about the photographic evidence, which is relatively trivial in my estimation, but rather the early life of Lyndon Johnson, how he became infatuated, obsessed with power, so manipulative, learned to lie and cheat from the very beginning, and of course forced himself on the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960, even though he had not been on Bobby or Jack's long list, much less their short, by threatening to expose that Jack had had dalliances with beautiful women who were spies for East Germany, that he suffered from Addison's disease and was not expected to live a long, healthy life, and furthermore asserted that if he were not on the ticket, that in his role as majority leader of the Senate, he'd bottle up any legislative proposals that were sent down from the White House that would be dead on arrival. We know more that I previously reviewed already in this series of rebuttals to James DiEugenio. Larry, I'm particularly interested in your assessment and more recent research about the Alton Six in relation to the Lyndon Johnson limousine, where you have some new discoveries to share with us. And I'll just take one further. You tell me when to advance the slide.
All right. Yeah, before we get started there, I wanted to make it clear that you can go to the Real Deal website, because Phil Nelson has already responded to this before, and he says that the guy that wrote that article or the review of his book had never even read the book. So if you want to know, there's a complete hour-long video at the Real Deal website. So I just wanted to let everyone know.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Larry.
Yeah, Jim, this is the isolation of the Alchin 6 photograph from that very well-defined Alchin 6 version that we've presented before, that was provided by Dennis Cimino, which is, once again, a much, much better and clearer version of the Alchin 6. And it's clear that there is some kind of alteration there in the area where Lyndon Johnson would have been
to Lady Bird's right, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And you can see, if you bring it even a little closer, you can see somebody's half head there, where there's been also an ink spot blocking the identity of that person, which we believe is Rufus Youngblood, who supposedly jumped over the seat and covered up LBJ during the shooting. And we know that that never happened either. But we've already mentioned that B.J. Martin had spoken about his actions, LBJ's actions, where he had been listening to a walkie-talkie type radio, and he had been crouching down in the seat. And then when the cars turn onto Elm Street, he was ducking at the time. And now, if you advance the slide, what we have done is
well, you can reiterate this criticism, which carries it forward. I would say, by the way, that a far more powerful indication of Lyndon's advanced knowledge was that he had a huge argument with JFK that morning. He wanted to get Connally out of the presidential limousine and
put Yarbrough
and put Ralph Yarbrough in, where Lyndon despised Yarbrough. JFK overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. But there was no time to notify the shooters, and therefore Connally, you notice, has a rather grim expression, understanding that he's going to be at risk. Why don't you read this, and then we'll continue with your critique.
Sure. Groden publishes Absolute Proof. Reduced Nelson's metaphysical certitude to rubble. On page 272, he makes a powerful case through photo analysis, which he knows something about. That one, you can see Johnson's head in the photo, and therefore two, what Nelson said did not happen. In other words, Joe Green's criticism was correct. Johnson did not duck down in the car at all. Moreover, as Groden wrote, he was probably as unaware as his wife, Lady Bird, that the shooting was even taking place, which, of course, is the opposite of Nelson's presentation. So much for Fetzer's, quote, masterpiece, unquote.
This is embarrassing. This is embarrassing after the man's mountain of proof we've adduced that Lyndon was involved to use this as though it were a pivot that could make a change in the mass of evidence is pathetic. Here's the next slide.
Yeah, this is last time when we finished the show, we were talking about precisely this portion of the Alchin 6, which is only available, and I might add, in the Saturday Evening Post version published on December the 14th, 1963. And this portion of the Alchin 6, as you can see, the ladies there on the curb of Elm Street have been identified as Mary Woodward, Ann Donaldson, Aurelia Lorenzo, and Margaret Brown, also known as Maggie Brown. Now, the middle portion
of the newspaper women.
Yes, they worked for the Dallas Morning News, okay? And I'm gonna specify exactly what each one of them did at the Dallas Morning News, because I've further researched all of them. And but the middle portion of this collage shows where I have outlined the areas of obfuscation where gigantic ink blotches or splotches have been inserted to cover up something. Okay, now if you look at the woman in the black dress, whom we have identified as Maggie Brown, is actually holding a film camera, probably a 16 millimeter or an 8 millimeter. Now, Maggie Brown was a copy editor, and a copy editor at any newspaper is an extremely important and powerful position, Jim, because this is the person who actually edits what all the reporters write.
The final words as are set into type.
That's right. So this woman, you know, wasn't just any person, you know, working at the Dallas Morning News. And she was accompanied by Aurelia Lorenzo, who was a reporter, and the other woman, Ann Donaldson, who was, I believe, a society editor. And Anna Donaldson was the society editor. Okay. And Margaret Brown, the copy editor, Aurelia Alonzo was a reporter, and of course the famous Mary Woodward, who was also a reporter. And Mary Woodward is the woman that we cited last week, who appeared in The Men Who Killed Kennedy, in chapter the third installment of Nigel Turner's series, where she talked about, you know, the shots coming from behind and above her, and that she had written a piece that afternoon where they had altered the wording of her experience, of what she had witnessed that afternoon. Okay,
and yeah, were you saying she was the first dissenting witness, Dr. Fetzer?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, because Peter Whitney wrote that. Thanks for mentioning that, Gary, because Peter Whitney wrote a very comprehensive article in the third decade in the early 90s. And that's exactly what he called her, the first dissenting witness. And he was the only researcher who actually talked about and wrote about what these women experienced that day. Okay, so the bottom portion of this collage, what I have done is I have located exactly the areas of obfuscation in the alternate six photograph. And this is by using Zapruder frame 166. Okay, if you look closely, you'll see that there is no area, no dark area, you know, covering these women here in the Zapruder film. So going back up to the middle, to the top two portions here of the collage, and when you compare those to the other angle of vision, which is from Zapruder's point of view, there's no area there of obfuscation. Okay, so obviously there's something terribly wrong here, and what I'm and my inference here is that both of these women had cameras, and both of these women were filming, either film obviously, I think Maggie Brown was filming. The other one might have had some other type of camera, unknown, because, you know, the area has been so much altered there. But then the at the bottom right is a portion of Dan Roberto's witness map, which places all four of the women there on at the curb of Elm Street. That's why this collage is very important here. And if you go on to the next slide, this is important because it locates the women. Okay, based on, if you look at the top there, you know, the woman, the short woman, you know, with the overcoat and the scarf there, the babushka. Okay, you can see I've drawn two arrows which locate her, and these are Zapruder frames 115 and 116. Okay. Now, at the bottom left, what appears to be, there is obviously a pocketbook, a purse of some type, but there's also what seems to be a ditty bag for a camera, okay, for some type of a camera, the black square package there seems to be, it looks to me, appears to be some sort of a carrying case for a camera. Okay, so that would give us even more proof that Maggie Brown, or maybe it's not Maggie, but one of the four women from the Dallas Morning News was filming from the curb there. Okay, and that gives us even further proof. And then if you look to the right there, there's another woman there also taking pictures. You can see clearly that she's got her hand right there where I've drawn a little arrow that says taking pictures, where she also seems to have been taking pictures. It looks clearly like she has a camera up to her face. Okay.
Just to carry the point home, you're implying their photographs would have shown whether Lyndon was or was not ducking in the car.
That's right, because that's our next slide, which we're going to show the line of sight of what Maggie Brown would have been filming. Okay, and it goes straight towards the LBJ limo. She's not filming. Interestingly enough, she's not filming over to her right where JFK had already passed her position. Okay, she's filming up Elm Street, and it seems to me that she is filming the area of LBJ's vehicle. So this is the reason why they had to obliterate that area, you know, especially identifying her as the one wielding the camera and filming up Elm Street where LBJ was located. And it's very curious that both of these women seem to have been obfuscated there, Jim. So that's why I thought that this sort of tied up what we had been, where we had left off last week.
I think that's very good, Larry. And after all, citing Robert Groton as a photographic expert, when he denies the existence of a blatant bullet hole in the windshield, when he has served as a conduit to frame Oswald by claiming the red and black shirt, which Billy wasn't even wearing that day, was a better match for the Oswald shirt than Oswald's, the doorman shirt than Oswald's, and for continuing to insist that the Zapruder film is authentic, it seems to me you have a multiplicity of arguments there, three strikes, as it were, that indicate that Robert Groton is untrustworthy when it comes to issues of this kind.
Well, this also cements our position that the Alton 6 has been altered, because we know that it's been massively altered, but this area is so egregious, Jim, that it's just so obvious here. There's just no other conclusion here. I've already shown this to other photographic experts who say, look, you know, it's obvious, you know, that area has been altered, and they've even given me ideas of how it was altered using ink pens and airbrushing and that sort of thing. So,
and of course, he's grasping after straws to place so much emphasis on this singular point. When, I mean, Phil Nelson has a book that's 500, 600 pages long. I mean, this is a really cherry picking, you know, trying to find something, anything you can find to disqualify a massive study that has overwhelming weight.
And it is circumstantial evidence here that supports Phil's position that LBJ was ducking, because otherwise why would they have you know, taken out that those two women there, you know, with that they were filming there.
I agree, Gary. I know you want to get a word in.
All right, so we know that Mary Woodward's story, she wrote a story and it was immediately changed. And Larry, am I right? Are you implicating the Dallas Morning News?
Well, by inference, it seems very possible, okay, there's a very high degree of probability that what they did was they hoarded these women in, you know, as soon as they came off the street. You know, the article by Peter Whitney describes how hysterical all four of the women were coming off of the street and seeing JFK get his brains blown out, where they needed the tranquilizers and that sort of thing, and where they were told to, you know, just shut up, you know, and give me the film, you know, or whatever it is that you took pictures, and, you know, forget this whole thing happened, you know. That's what it seems like what would happen here, you know.
Connie Pittsburgh also worked for the Dallas Morning News, and she was furious to find a story she'd written based on the Parkland press conference had been altered. Right. The physicians weren't sure if this was caused by one shot or two. I mean, she had the description of the wound to the throat and an entrance wound, which Malcolm Perry described three different times. She was extremely upset about it and remains so to this very day.
And it brings, like Gary said, the Dallas Morning News right in the center, you know, of this whole controversy, because not only would they have been the entity that received Maggie's film, but they also received Alton's camera and his roll of film, and then sent Alton's over to a Parkland hospital immediately, where Alton's was not the person who developed his film, and he doesn't know exactly what happened to it after he gave it up at the Dallas Morning News.
Yeah, I wonder what Michael Collins Piper would say about who's running the Dallas News.
All right, how about point number four now?
Joan Mellon and Mac Wallace fingerprint. The other cinching point that Nelson abided by in his book was the Malcolm Wallace fingerprint. This was the belated discovery by the late researcher Jay Harrison that Wallace's fingerprint was one of the unidentified prints found on the sixth floor. Nelson put this piece of information in his book. He then criticized others for not accepting it. Page 589 to 590. It turns out that he should have double checked it first himself. Joan Mellon did that. Her computer analysis has shown that it is not Wallace's fingerprint. Her book on this subject and the whole Mac Wallace episode will be released this fall. The question in regard to our titular subject on this, how could anyone call this book a masterpiece? By doing so, Fetzer was placing his own credibility on the block with the book.
Well, he cited two claims, one about the not have ducked, Lyndon not have ducked, for which we've offered circumstantial evidence suggesting he actually had ducked, but where I'm pointing out that that's just, you know, grasping after straws. And when Phil Nelson cites the fingerprint, he's citing many others, including Walt Brown, who made a very big point of this at the time, received a great deal of publicity. So is Jim DiEugenio now also faulting Walt Brown? Here we have a nice talk about the fingerprint itself. In 1998, A. Nathan Darby executed an affidavit in which he confirmed a match between a latent fingerprint found on one of the cardboard boxes that comprised the Texas School Book Depository Sniper's Nest and the ink print of Malcolm Wallace. Subsequently, Darby's match has been criticized by some people who have the requisite qualifications to critique his work and by many who don't. A few observations on the debate that has surrounded the fingerprint issue follow based on wading through the mire of opinions over the year, with a significant caveat that I'm certainly not professionally qualified in this field. One, Darby originally identified 14 matching points between the inked and latent prints that were given to him. While there is some debate on the amount of matching points necessary to make a definitive judgment on the match, the FBI suggests 8. Some other countries require as many 16. U.S. courts normally will accept 10 to 12. A 14-point match testified to in court by a certified latent print examiner with proper experience and credentials will generally clinch a case. 2. Subsequently, criticism of Darby's match by fingerprint experts focus on dissimilarities between the latent and ink print. Darby addressed these points directly, noting that Wallace had sustained an injury, a laceration, which upon healing created a non-corresponding area near the delta in the latent. Other criticism amounted to ignoring the pressure distortion created by hosting heavy boxes. Little or no substantive criticism was made of Darby's matching points. 3. Darby's match was a blind match. Another Texas-based fingerprint expert, E.H. Hoffmeister, when presented with the two prints that had been given to Darby, concluded that they were made by the same person. When he was told that the Kennedy assassination was involved, he backed off the identification. The experts who concluded the match was in error all knew the consequences of a positive match. In a perfect world, this would not be important. In this world, unfortunately, even forensic judgments made by experienced scientists can be colored by many factors. The only two blind, scientifically proper submissions of latent print from the book carton and the ink Wallace print resulted in a match. I think those blind matches really are the weighty ones clearly those are the ones untainted by political, emotional, or other considerations. Here we have the actual prints that were matched. And now I would say, therefore, that as a criticism of Phil Nelson's work, that it's a failure. It doesn't establish the point.
Fetzer grasping at straws. But what does Fetzer's lack of circumspection and gravitas do for the rest of the interested public? It's in the cases of Gregory Douglas, Ralph Sinclair, Judith Baker, and Peter Janney, it shows just how Fetzer is so eager to accept and how blindly he does accept practically anything that comes down the pike in the JFK field, almost as if the wilder and more unfounded it is, the better, which is nearly the precise opposite of what the function of criticism is.
Yeah, well, anyone can go through this entire lengthy discourse in which I'm rebutting point after point after point, and we have yet to find even one on which Jim DiEugenio has made a solid case. That, to me, is very damning. And if anyone lacks circumspection and gravitas, that would appear to be Jim DiEugenio rather than me. Moreover, the book by Gregory Douglas, Regicide, has been generally well received by 62 customers. I found it quite a fascinating piece, but after about 48 hours, I concluded that it had been a fraud. My reasoning based upon the fact that it begins with an analysis of the shooting by the Soviet Union, which is almost an exact replication of the Secret Service. The Soviets would have known that 8, 9, or 10 shots had been fired, not merely 3. So I revised my initial favorable impression. Now, maybe Jim DiEugenio thinks that's unacceptable practice. My understanding of rationality is that as you obtain new information and new alternative hypotheses, it's incumbent upon you to alter your opinion if they make that appropriate. Here's what I wrote in my review, which he could have found online. It's not suppressed. It's right there on Amazon.com, where it has been since March 30th, 2002. Regicide promises several new documents related to the death of JFK. One, an English translation of an undated study by the Soviet Union. Two, a 20 April 1978 Defense Intelligence Agency study. Three, a summary of Operation Zipper, dated 22 November 1963. And four, Gregory Douglas's own critical comments and critique. These items, 1 through 3, allegedly came into his possession through a fortuitous encounter with Robert T. Crowley, a former deputy director for operations of the CIA, an expert on Soviet intelligence. Douglas claims to have had extensive conversation with Crowley from 1993 to 1996 when his health took a bad turn. He died in 2000. According to Douglas, Crowley had taken numerous documents with him upon his retirement from the CIA and occasionally shared them with various historians. As he came to trust Douglas, he became increasingly forthcoming, especially about the sequence of events that led to the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The Soviet assassination summary includes a 3-shot sequence with a driver slowing the limousine to a virtual stop where JFK was hit in the throat from in front, John Connally was hit from above and behind, and JFK was hit in the head from behind. According to the Soviet study, Lee Oswald was recruited by ONI and used his pseudo-defection as an occasion to convey valuable information about the U-2 program, which subsequently enabled the Soviets to shoot down a plane piloted by Gary Powers. Oswald had an extensive history with the CIA, later the FBI, where because of his defection and new persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer, he became a useful pawn as the designated patsy when the assassination went down. Serious students of this case will find much here that has the ring of truth. The reconstruction of the shooting falls short on all of these accounts, since we now know much more about what happened in Dealey Plaza and how it was covered up. But those familiar with bloody treason and body of secrets will appreciate the extent to which the big picture fixed. One of the most disturbing aspects of Zipper, however, is a set of 5 appendices, not included, alleged to be photographs of JFK in sexual situations with various of his alleged paramours. These were supposedly to have been given out as mementos, but that defies credulity. What politician would run such a risk? Surely not JFK. The very existence of the Zipper document is likely to generate the most controversy, since it's difficult to imagine that the principals of the assassination would record their meetings about it. This appears to be a case in which documents that appear to be too good to be true are indeed too good to be true. Douglas maintains that Crowley's willingness to assist him in these ways was largely motivated by a driving desire to attain a sense of exoneration by explaining why he and others who played crucial roles were convinced that JFK had to be removed. He offers a chilling scenario. The skeleton of this account may well be true, but the documents on which it is based appear to have been fabricated. The corrupt objective, alas, may be to present a largely accurate account based upon phony records whose exposure as forgeries is meant to discredit the account itself. I wish it were not so, but that is how things appear. I must say, if Jim DiEugenio is going to undertake a criticism of me and fault me in relation to regicide, he ought at least to acknowledge that I had reconsidered my initial favorable impression and had published a revised evaluation with a one-star review as long ago as 2002. That's a form of suppression of evidence that makes his case overwhelmingly weaker in this instance, and it's an indication of the slipshod method, the full lack of a critical methodology employed by Jim DiEugenio.
Yeah.
Larry.
Yeah, go ahead and unmute, Larry.
Yeah. Fetzer endorses Hanke's work. Seamus Coogan has written several fine articles for this website, e.g., on the Majestic Papers and on Alex Jones. But the first article which brought Seamus to the attention of the JFK critical community was his long and detailed critique of John Hanke's documentary, first titled JFK 2. It was then retitled Dark Legacy. Hanke's film tried to make the case for the involvement of former President George H.W. Bush in the murder of President Kennedy. As Seamus revealed, it was not successful.
Well, whether or not John Hanke was completely successful is a different question than whether George H.W. Bush was involved in the assassination. Here I feature John Hanke as the second of my speakers in Santa Barbara. John Hanke, an expert on the role of George H.W. Bush in the assassination of JFK, has produced and directed JFK 2, The Bush Connected, also known as Dark Legacy, George Bush and the Murder of John F. Kennedy. He also authored Was George H.W. Bush Involved in the Assassination of JFK? John has been teaching history and English in the L.A. city school system and so forth. Well, here's John actually making his presentation in Santa Barbara. Well, John is not the only one who has studied the role of George Herbert Walker Bush. I highly recommend. Richard Hook did George H.W. Bush coordinate a JFK hit team. Well, it's very clear that we know that Bush was working for the CIA early on, that he appears to have run the Bay of Pigs operation, which was codenamed Operation Zapata, that the Bush family oil drinking firm was Zapata, that two of the boats were rechristened, one Barbara, the other Houston. It appears to me that Zapata, had the invasion been a success, would have had the concession to drill for oil all over the Caribbean basin. Here we have further Richard Hook's identification of Edward Lansdale, identified walking past the three tramps by no less authorities than L. Fletcher Prouty, the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA for covert activities, who was a basis for the figure Colonel X and Oliver Stone's JFK, and Victor Krulak. His brother who was the commandant of the Marine Corps, not Victor himself, but was a celebrated Marine Corps general. As for the identity of George Herbert Walker Bush, we have these observations from Ralph Sinquet, a professional chiropractor who's an expert in dealing with persons' bodies and clothing. The case for George H.W. being there is cinch. What's the serious alternative? That a simply amazing coincidence occurred in which a man who looks strikingly like him just happened to be there? How many times does V for Vendetta in the film V for Vendetta have to tell us that he, like God, does not blame dice and does not believe in coincidences? Neither do I. So we have a photo of Bush in front of the book depository, a photo of Lansdale walking past the three troops, and here a third photo, Lansdale waiting to speak to Bush. Richard Hook has done brilliant work in identifying the shooting location framed by the fire escape in the Dow Techs. It's a masterpiece, in my opinion. Here he identifies the Deltek's Hick team. Notice the matching hairline. I've identified Nestor Tony Escadro as having fired from that location. And where, if you were to go to Little Havana, you'd find in Freedom Park two statues, one of whom is to Marty, who freed Cuba from Spanish domination, the other to Escadro. And you ask someone, well, what's that statue doing there? If they are knowledgeable, they would reply, he took care of business. He fired the shot that hit JFK in the back of the head during the limo stop. Here's a memorandum from J. Edgar Hoover about the assassination of JFK that talks about George Herbert Walker Bush having made a phone call to advise that an anti-Castro group might capitalize on the present situation, and where in particular we have here George H.W. Bush making a phone call to furnish information that he wanted to be kept confidential. He recalled hearing a James Parrott having talked about killing the president when he came to Houston. I mean, this is such a transparent attempt to create an alibi by George Herbert Walker Bush that it actually backfires, in my opinion. And Larry and Gary, as you know, Richard even discovered photographs of W there. He seems to be lost, apparently not knowing where his father was, because he was arrested coming out of the Daltex building. He was taken downtown. He identified himself as an independent Houston oil man. He was never booked and then returned to Dealey Plaza, where he awaited the arrival of General Edward Lansdale, who many of us regard as a person who actually organized the assassination in terms of positioning the shooters and determining the sequence of shots.
Yeah, it's never been disputed that he was in Dallas that day. In fact, he advertised in the paper that he'd be speaking in Dallas, Texas. So it's not like we just made it up out of the blue. He was in Texas that day, as was Richard Nixon.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Well, my opinion of the previous slide where the Hoover memo, I thought is very damning and devastating because it seems to me that Hoover was in some manner documenting in writing that, you know, the CIA and George H.W. Bush were involved in this thing, Jim. You know, I think it's the smoking gun here of this whole thesis here of George H.W. Bush being involved.
Well, it's certainly clear that whether or not Hanke established the point, in my judgment, Richard Hook has established the point. And it's another indication of the slovenly approach of Jim DiEugenio, that he's not looking at all of the available evidence. Now, it turns out that DiEugenio vastly broadens the scope of his interest in my work by turning his attention to Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which I founded in December of 2005. Larry, would you like to read the paragraphs below the heading for Scholars?
Sure. In the 9/11 field in 2005, Fetzer teamed up with former Brigham Young professor Stephen Jones to form something called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Jones is actually a scientist. He has a PhD in physics from Vanderbilt. Jones did postdoctoral work at Cornell and has worked at two linear accelerators, one at Stanford and one at Los Alamos. He also worked as at a research lab from 1979 to 1985 and the Department of Energy for several years into the 90s. He is an acknowledged expert on fusion. In 2005, Jones presented a paper on his BYU-sponsored website attempting to explain the collapse of the Twin Towers by way of thermite explosives. Yet 1 year after Jones and Fetzer teamed up, they got a divorce. Why Fetzer would want to split from such a reputable scientist? He and Jones split over something that is literally hard to describe. I actually still do not understand it.
Scientist split.
In his own way, it's as far out as the Fetzer Sinke Alchin's altered photo to disguise Oswald nonsense. I first heard about it through Joseph Green, the Sitka correspondent who reviewed Philip Nelson's book for this website. meeting with Lisa Peace and myself on a weekend he spent in L.A. several years ago, he told us, "Did you hear about what the 9/11 people are now proposing?" Since I did not follow that field, I said, "No, I didn't." Joe replied, "They are now saying that the towers were leveled by space beings. No plane hit them, and what people saw was a giant hologram." I said, "You can't be serious." Joe replied, "Yes, I am, and Fetzer is part of it."
Yeah, but just what part of it I am is a very interesting question, because, in fact, the thermite hypothesis, nanothermite, turns out to be hopelessly indefensible. I was already convinced of that by June of 2006, and therefore later in the year, November 11th, 2006, I first interviewed Judy Wood because I believe scholars had to broaden the scope of its consideration of alternative theories. In particular, here's a very important step. Turns out that for a high explosive to blow apart a material, its detonation velocity has to be greater than the speed of sound in that material. But the speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, and in steel, 6,100 meters per second, where the highest detonation velocity attributed to nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, meaning you can't get there from there. It's a hopelessly indefensible hypothesis. I would publish three articles with T. Mark Hightower about it. And with regard to Judy Wood, just to ever so briefly introduce this subject, which we will obviously continue next week. I originally gave a 5-star review because of the comprehensive way she brought together an enormous quantity of evidence. But after the Vancouver hearings, I observed then in passing that she had not excluded mini or micro nukes, and that drew thousands of comments. After the Vancouver hearings in 2012, I revised it to a 3-star review, which I shall now read. "Impressive but severely flawed argument by elimination. Rather than advance a theory of her own, Judy Wood, PhD, has brought together an enormous quantity of high-quality evidence that functions as a partial foundation for evaluating alternative explanation. What she has done has classically been referred to as a prolegomenon, or as a prelude to further research. The word indirect belongs in her subtitle, since indirect evidence of directed free energy technology on 9/11 is a less misleading and closer approximation. She demonstrates that the Twin Towers cannot possibly have collapsed, and that some massive source of energy was required to blow them apart and convert them into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. That also cannot have been done by thermite, thermate, nanothermite. She offers reasons for doubting that it was done by using nukes, but her arguments actually only rule out large nukes in the sub-basements, not sophisticated arrangements of micro or mini nukes. New evidence based upon the U.S. Geological Survey's dust samples indicates that the destruction of the Twin Towers was primarily a nuclear event. The most important defect in her book is a failure to report or come to grips with the presence of barium and strontium, thorium and uranium, lithium, lanthanum, yttrium, chromium, and tritium, where she mentions the latter but inexplicably minimizes the values for tritium that were obtained, which was scientifically irresponsible. The idea that directed energy weapons were used is seriously underdeveloped, where her strongest claim is that dews provide vastly more energy than conventional explosives and can be directed. Anyone familiar with the gross observable evidence knows the former to be true, or mini or micro nukes, not to mention a new positron antimatter technology, satisfy both conditions. For the latest on best and how it was done, serious students should check out the Vancouver hearings. I am not done responding to Di Eugenio's hopelessly inadequate discussion of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which will continue next week. Gary.
You're listening to the new JFK show. We've got Larry Rivera, Jim Fetzer, Gary King, and we'll be back for another round next week. Chance and Engineer's Chair, sorry.